The next matter, number 25-1146, United States versus Raheem Sharfa. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please come to the podium and introduce himself on the record to begin.
Martin Weinberg on behalf of appellant Dr. Sharfa. This appeal raises both important errors regarding sentencing and the use of acquitted conduct and may present, there's no reported decision yet applying the November 1, 2024 guideline amendment that changes how acquitted conduct can intersect with relevant conduct. So this may be the first opportunity for a federal appellate decision on this important guideline. But I'd like first to argue briefly one of the trial issues, which is the court's exclusion under 804B1 of the proffered evidence of an out-of-court sworn statement by Mr. Wayne Moran.
Just pause 1 second. I just want to make sure the clock is working, Dan.
Oh, it's not.
Judge. Now it is.
Okay, go ahead. Please continue.
I'm reminded to ask for 2 minutes for a rebuttal, if Your Honor, please. Thank you. Mr. Moran was the person that exported a compound pellet, which Dr. Sharfa, as a psychiatrist, would use in his treatment decisions with patients who not otherwise conquer opiate addiction through the more traditional methodologies. This pellet was not FDA approved, which was the bottom line for the series of convictions for smuggling, for paying for the exports, which constituted international money laundering, and for an FDA.
Counsel, excuse me. I think we know the background. Let me just identify for you what bothers me about your argument, so
Thank
that you
Georgia.
Can respond to it. In my mind, the government made an effective argument that in that prior trial, Mr. Moran was testifying in a very different capacity. There, he was called by the government as a cooperating witness as part of their case against Dr. Guberman. And so they had no incentive to discredit his account of what that customs official in Anchorage had told somebody who told him. Whereas here, if that testimony was introduced through the record of that prior trial, there are a ton of questions that they would want to be able to ask, and of course they couldn't. He's not there to discredit what he said. I mean, doesn't that justify the exclusion of his testimony, even though that may not have been the basis on which the judge ruled? That does seem to me a compelling argument as to why there was no error in excluding that testimony.
And I think that becomes a construction issue of how the court wants to apply 804B1. You know, clearly here it met the other elements of the rule, and the question is whether the government had a similar interest in cross-examining Moran. I submit that the redirect examination in the Guberman trial, which appears at the appendix 339 to 41 of the Sharfa appendix, reflects the government's wanting to impeach Mr. Moran on this point. Yes, gently impeach him because they didn't want to extinguish his credibility because they were relying on him as a co-conspirator, just like the government in this case relied on him as a co-conspirator in several of the counts that led to acquittals. But they did want to discredit, and they admitted in their brief that they were on the same side of us at believing that the specific Moran testimony, that he was in good faith in allowing his office manager to put plastic beads in replace of a drug on the label, that was not testimony that the government accepted in the Guberman trial, and they certainly didn't accept it in the Sharfa trial. And when you read the redirect, they have him agree that that's the description that his office manager gave, and then they say, wouldn't it have been more accurate if you put down drug or naltrexone, which is the specific drug? He admits it would have been more accurate. They then ask on redirect, and isn't it a fact that you would have suffered a greater chance of having a seizure if you accurately labeled the export shipment package? And Mr. Moran said yes. That was a recognition that although they had to walk a fine line between not trying to blow up a witness that they were relying on for other purposes, they recognized, and they've agreed, they had a similar motive and didn't accept and did distrust that level of testimony, and they did their best to walk that line. That's all the rule requires. The rule actually on its face talks about the prior testimony can be on direct, redirect, cross-exam. You don't need an identical motive. You need a specific motive. And you look not in general to, there's no prohibition that a witness called by one party can't have out-of-court testimony called by a different party. It's whether the specific testimony was, they were both on the same side. And I think this redirect demonstrates that the government recognized and they cross-examined him on redirect, although not in the kind of unconditional way they would have if they were not relying on him on other points.
Counsel, in a footnote in the Bartello decision, we said that if there were strategic reasons for a party not to ask certain questions during prior testimony, that would not be enough to take it out of the exception. Do you know if there's any case law interpreting what strategic, what would qualify as a strategic decision, which it seems to me is essentially what you're arguing right now, that the government asked a few questions but strategically decided not to ask every question that it could?
Yep.
Do you have any cases that have really touched on this issue?
Not directly and not beyond the ones we cited for the similarity of interest the definition.
If I'm following your argument, the strategic reason for them not to have asked those extra questions in that context had to do with a different motivation for using the witness there than here. Is that right?
Yes.
So why doesn't that support the position the government advanced that Judge Lopez was asking you about, which is that strategy can be all kinds of different things, but when the strategy is generated by a differing motive as to the use of the witness, doesn't that then suggest it's not the same interest that they have?
And had they had an interest in accepting this portion of Mr. Moran's testimony, we would not have a credible principled 804b1 argument. But in fact, the government didn't accept it. They even said in their brief, we were on the same side as Dr. Schaffer in distrusting.
Yeah, but in the posture in which he was testifying, their interest in going into that harder was not the same as it would be here, and that doesn't seem like a strategic point about how to use it when you have the same interest. That seems like a different approach given the different interest. What's wrong with that characterization of it?
I think that characterization is correct. However, I don't think that takes it outside of the rule, because I think the test is, was there a similar motive or interest? And I think the redirect would demonstrate that the government did impeach its own witness on this point, and I think that's all that's required to allow the second defendant, Dr. Schaffer, to use and admit the testimony, and that's the point that's raised by the substantive issue. I'd like to, however, address the sentencing issues, which I think are important. The Sentencing Commission, in its acquitted conduct history, talked about the fact that we've watched a dwindling of the jury trial right. Only 2.5% of defendants.
Only because of time, I don't discount the importance of the guideline and the background to it, but doesn't it reduce to the question of what involving fraud means
in
this case?
Excuse me, Judge.
Doesn't the question here reduce to what the guideline that uses the phrase involving fraud means, or am I wrong about that?
I think it's whether or not it's what the guideline that says that the acquitted conduct must establish in whole or in part the crime of conviction, I think is the key to interpreting the guideline consistent with
how it works, because it just walk me through how we get to the enhancement here that you're saying is barred.
Misbranding conviction, misdemeanor, no mens rea, elements did not require proof of fraud. Government subjects under count 9, special verdict, felony acquittal. key question is whether the fraud or the whatever evidence they have.
But I'm trying to think, what I'm trying to walk through is we have the guideline that was applied here that you're objecting to is what?
The guideline is the 2B1.1, which is a cross-reference to 2N2.1, which is the misbranding guideline for misdemeanor.
To get to the ultimate one that's applying the enhancement, don't we have to go through a guideline that only sends you there if it's a crime involving fraud? Is that right or wrong?
Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't that mean that the relevant thing we should be construing here is that phrase involving fraud?
On two levels, Judge. One is whether there was facts to show involving fraud, but as a result of the acquitted conduct guideline, whether those facts, if available, were acquitted, were the facts that were relevant only to the felonies that the jury rejected.
But doesn't that depend on whether we can only look at, we've got a conviction for an offense that qualifies as involving fraud for the guideline that sends you there.
Meaning the misdemeanor misbranding, which doesn't have any fraudulent element, yes. And the commission says if the misdemeanor, which the index points to only one guideline, 2N2.1, if that offense, misdemeanor, misbranding, involved fraud, go to the fraud guideline.
And what are you saying about that? Involving fraud or did not?
I believe factually they didn't prove that there was patient fraud, which is the fraud that deals with the results.
And what about the importation count and how that gets us there?
Well, the importation count has to go first to misbranding. So you're still at the same crucial level of whether the misbranding conviction involved fraud. The smuggling conviction, again, the index points to 2T3.1, a separate guideline. You only get to misbranding because the imported drug was contraband, meaning a drug. Therefore, they have the choice of a higher guideline. The misbranding guideline was higher.
The court, in kind of a commonsensical way, looked at the counts of conviction, and at the heart, they involve a misrepresentation under oath on a declaration, which is part of the importation process, which mischaracterized the items that were being brought into the country. I mean, that seems to be quintessential fraudulent conduct. You are making a misrepresentation about the nature of the items being imported. Isn't that sort of how the judge looked at it?
Yes.
I mean, there's fraud all over these convictions.
The judge took it all as relevant conduct, but what she didn't do is apply the acquitted conduct guideline properly. The acquitted conduct guideline was intended to not to recodify judicial discretion, which has occurred since the Watts decision and was the subject of all this criticism. The guideline was implemented to narrow that, and we argue that
counsel, if I could just ask you to focus in on it, there was clearly evidence of false customs documents, so why is it incorrect for the district court here to conclude that the convicted conduct, not the acquitted conduct, the convicted conduct involved fraud? It involved the defendant knowingly using false customs documents. Why doesn't that qualify, under your understanding of the new guideline?
For two reasons. One is a more technical reading, which is that the smuggling guideline only takes you so far as the misbranding guideline. The cross-reference was from smuggling to misbranding. It was not directly to fraud. In order to get to fraud, you had to find that the misbranding involved fraud. The misbranding didn't involve fraud. And the acquittals for felony intent to defraud, the acquittal for intent to conspiracy to defraud ICE were relevant to that decision. But second, the customs violations could be proven in narrow ways, which is that the judge gave two options to the jury. One was simply the importation of misbranded drugs. That would be knowingly committing a crime. Only one of the two options was not being reasonable in what you declared to customs. that although there was false statements to customs, it's speculative whether or not the jury relied on that and found fraud within the smuggling counts rather than relying on the simple importation of a misbranded drug,
and
which would have...
On that second point, is that a categorical approach that you're asking us to adopt? Or are you saying even under a fact-based approach, we would come out the same way? You're probably going to say both, but I take it that the first thing you just said, is that implicitly saying we should adopt a categorical approach to the phrase involving fraud?
Yes, you should look at
and whether... And so what's the basis for reading the phrase involving fraud to adopt the categorical approach? Because that's not usually the language that either the guidelines or the statutes use that trigger the categorical approach.
I think it's the involving fraud would normally be a determination whether there was sufficient evidence of fraud to substitute a fraud guideline in place of the guidelines that the index brought you to. Here, because the fraud was the heart of all of these acquitted conduct counts, conspiracy to fraud.
But we're talking about the convicted counts.
The convicted counts.
With the convicted counts, you seem to be saying there was a way to convict that would not require proof of fraud.
Yes.
But that wouldn't be the relevant question in a fact-based inquiry, whether this offense, more likely than not, was committed in a manner that involved fraudulent conduct.
And in the absence of special verdicts, we don't know what the jury relied on to
correct.
Get
and we don't have to if the judge can make a finding that it's making its judgment by a preponderance. Are you just saying that was clear error on its part?
Yes, and moreover, a customs fraud, and I submit that there were, that the lies to customs were inherent in smuggling. And yet, you know, they lied about the value. They lied about the content. That's the heart of smuggling. And yet, the guideline doesn't have involved with fraud as a cross-reference in the smuggling guideline. The smuggling guideline only takes you to misbranding.
Yeah, but still, if it takes you to the misbranding, unless I'm missing something, for purposes of the acquitted conduct, isn't the smuggling still the conviction that matters, or not?
The smuggling conviction matters, but
that's just it. And then the question we ask is: did that conviction of that offense involve fraud?
And I would argue that it is only gets you to the fraud guideline through misbranding, and the misbranding conviction is a misdemeanor that doesn't require fraud and doesn't get proven by fraud.
Right, but the district court is still looking at the relevant conduct. So why does it matter that they're only the district court only got there through the misbranding guideline, because still at the end of the day, the district court is looking at what relevant conduct I can consider in fashioning what I believe is the correct sentence.
And I would contest two things. One is that the smuggling of the drug is not relevant conduct to a simple no mens rea misdemeanor labeling issue. The label on the drug, the absence of an RX, the absence of a manufacturer, is different than the misstatements on the shipping documents, which claimed it to be plastic beads. In other words, it's a long reach to say that we're going to switch out of misbranding guideline to a fraud guideline based on several misstatements on the packaging of ship documents. You know, the misbranding guideline goes specifically to a label that the FDA requires includes directions on use, RX, and the manufacturing. Second, the relevant conduct and its intersection with acquitted conduct, that given the lack of hard evidence that the smuggling was proven by a jury finding of the seat on customs, although that was part of the evidence and that was one of the options. This was largely, they're enhancing the fraud guideline based on losses to patients, based on how many victims were patients. That has nothing to do with customs fraud. It has everything to do with patient fraud. The patient fraud was directly acquitted conduct. The jury found that FDA misbranding with the intent to deceive patients was a not guilty. So that even if you get to the fraud guideline to use the customs deceit to enhance by 16 levels the sentence that otherwise would be imposed for smuggling or for fraud without the enhancements often misbranding, could only be used with acquitted conduct. And that's what drove the sentence. That's what multiplied it from a 0 to 6 or a 6 to 12 base offense level up to a guideline of 63 to 78 months. It was using the acquittal of the patient fraud to impose loss and gain, to impose how many victims, to impose special harm. If the smuggling ends up involving fraud, it has no enhancements. It's the same base offense level 6. None of the enhancements correlated to whether or not they devalued the loss. In fact, the smuggling guideline talks about how much tax loss it was because of the deprivation of a customs duty, something the government didn't ask for, they didn't get. The judge just took the smuggling deceit, and suddenly we end up with a sentence of 3 years and a guideline of 63 to 78 months that's based purely on acquitted conduct, the patient harm that was the heartland of the counts that the jury found to be not guilty.
Thank you.
So that's the essential argument on the acquitted conduct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the appellee please introduce herself on the record to begin?
Good morning. May it please the court. Unless the court has a... Oh, Karen Eisenstadt for the government. Unless the court has a different preference, I wanted to start where defense counsel started in terms of the Moran testimony and make just a couple points about that.
Do you mind, since the guideline issue is so technical, and it just happens to be in my mind, if you could start with that.
Absolutely. So the acquitted conduct amendment didn't preclude the use of the fraud cross-reference here because the district court found the fraudulent aspect of the importations established in whole or in part the defendant's smuggling convictions, counts 6 through 8. His argument appears to be that somehow we can...
And just walk me through... The actual guideline that we're applying that would apply the enhancement is the loss guideline?
Right. So I can
so
walk through
just walk the, me yeah. through how it gets
Absolutely.
So I can just figure out what text I'm supposed to be looking at
right.
at what point.
Exactly. So he's convicted of smuggling, misdemeanor, misbranding, money laundering. So the court needs to calculate guidelines for each of them and then pick the highest one. The easiest way to get at it is to say, well, he was convicted of smuggling, counts 6 through 8. The offense guideline for smuggling is 2T3.1, which says if the offense involves a contraband item covered by another offense guideline, you go there. And here it did because it was misbranded drugs. So that takes us to the misbranding guideline. But we're still looking here, of course, the calculation for the smuggling convictions. The misbranding guideline then says 2N2.1, C1, there's a cross-reference. If the offense involved fraud, then apply 2B1.1, which is the fraud guideline.
And the offense, on your view, at that point, is not misbranding, it's smuggling?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct,
because
that's what we're calculating
for. And if
we
agree with you on that score, then the relevant question for us is, does smuggling constitute an offense that was involving fraud?
That is correct.
Okay, and if involving fraud requires the categorical approach, then what?
So I don't think it does involve.
I understand.
We'll
just go step by step. But if it did, then what?
If it's a categorical approach.
Because I think what your opponent was saying is, under the categorical approach, it's not obvious that smuggling requires a finding of something that would constitute fraud that
sounds right,
right?
That sounds right, yes.
Okay,
there
so
are
the
ways
implicit
to prove
in your
smuggling.
Position is yep. that involving fraud does not adopt the categorical approach and that we have to read that to be a fact-based approach, correct?
That's correct. And I also don't understand the defense in their briefing to have challenged the idea of whether the smuggling convictions involved fraud. I mean, that I don't understand that argument to have been made either way.
So you think it's easy as pie because offense means the smuggling. They're not challenging smuggling involved fraud. So when we get to the acquitted conduct guideline, it's no big deal because this is just offense for which there was a conviction that involved fraud. That's the end of it. That's your basic position.
Correct. That's how we understand the district court was thinking about it, and
okay, just,
that is how we think about it.
Just
yes.
humor me. And if they were contesting that it was involving fraud, smuggling itself, how does your analysis go that leads us to the conclusion we can look at the facts as to how this particular smuggling offense was committed?
So I'd just like to push back a little, assuming the point of the categorical approach, but I'd like to push back a little because the court did decide, use this cross-reference in the Kumar case, and it was not a categorical approach. It was looking at what Kumar did and how he smuggled and whether it involved fraud. So I don't think the categorical approach works here. If it is, I think I've conceded that there are ways to smuggle that don't involve fraud. As a factual matter.
And just on, before we get the fact, just so I understand it, what's the reason to read involving fraud as not triggering the categorical approach? Because it doesn't use the word element, doesn't have conviction. I'm just trying to figure out how are we supposed to figure out when we use that approach and when we don't under the guidelines?
So these types of cross-references are all over the guidelines. Yeah. You know, one offense guideline says, well, this offense involves X, you go to another one. So the assumption in how it works is that it's not categorical, because if it always does, then you would just say, always go to that one. But it's like the district court, did this guy do it in a way that involves this thing? So that's why I think we've always assumed, and the defendant doesn't contest, this is depends on how you committed the crime.
Okay, and then with respect to how he committed it here, you would just say by a preponderance the judge could find he committed it through deceitful conduct, so that's the end of it?
That's correct, yes. Yeah. If the court doesn't have further questions about the acquitted conduct, I could turn back to the evidentiary issues.
Yeah, maybe just one last question. I guess the necessary premise of this whole argument on your part is that the word offense when you get to the kicks you into misbranding and then there's that word offense, even though misbranding got you there, the word offense should still be referring back to smuggling.
So that's how I read it, but I don't think actually that's required. So it's offense is a defined term in the guidelines in sort of the definition section, and it says offense means the instant offense of conviction and relevant conduct, as Judge Rickleman, I think, pointed out. So in Kumar, when they thought that the smuggling involved fraud, they were actually looking at relevant conduct because he hadn't even been convicted of misbranding.
But the offense can't mean misbranding on your view, right? For you to win.
Not the instant offense of conviction, but the relevant conduct. Of course, the misbranding was relevant
conduct.
Correct.
So your view is misbranding isn't trying to be the offense or anything. It's just the convenient thing to look to figure out how to apply the guidelines when the offense of conviction is smuggling in this instance. That's the
right.
idea?
That's what the guidelines instruct. Yeah. Courts okay, to do it. Is that if it involved contraband, that's where we want you to go to calculate. And I note he makes a point about general unfairness that, like, you know, this drove up his guidelines a lot based on because the fraud guideline then takes you into calculations of loss, it related to the patients. On that point, this is about calculating the guidelines and just following the rules correctly. On that point, of course, those are all arguments the district court can take into account under 3553A. And here the court varied downward quite significantly after correcting calculating the guideline. Just jumping back quickly to Moran, I just wanted to make two points that I think are responsive to his reply, not necessarily fully covered in the government's briefing. First, he makes an argument that he preserved this claim because he asked the court to make a 804B1 similar motive finding as to Moran's intent, separate from Shafa's intent, under conspiracy. So he sort of says that's enough because it's a similar motive finding and it's a similar issue. He did not actually ask that. If you look at the record, and as his own brief makes clear, this is page 10 of his opening brief, his request to admit Moran's testimony as to the conspiracy was based solely on rules 106 and his constitutional rights. It had nothing to do with 804B1, and thus there's no way the district court could have taken that as a request to please make a similar motive determination as to Moran's intent sort of standing alone. He also makes a point about the government's redirect of Moran in the Guberman trial. And I would just note there that, you know, there was a couple redirect questions. Did you think it sound advice, or did you think that was accurate? What the government notably did not do, and would have had an interest in doing this case, was, like, did you just make this up? Like, did this even happen? But that would have been, of course, a whole different type of impeachment of the government's own witness.
Counsel, there's a point here that does confuse me. I thought that, in part, defense counsel was asking for the admission of this Moran testimony in hopes of then being able to argue that Moran could not have the requisite intent to commit the crimes at issue. And if he did not have the requisite intent, the doctor here could not be aiding and abetting him in that offense, and that it understood that you were pursuing an aiding and abetting theory, at which point the government says, we are prosecuting the doctor as a principal. And so whether Moran had the requisite intent just doesn't matter. To me, this record is quite confusing as to whether the government was proceeding on a principal theory or an aiding and abetting theory. The indictment alleges both. The court instructed on both. So I don't know how you can argue that the government was proceeding solely on a principal theory of liability when there's so much in the record that suggests to the contrary. And so this basis for objecting to admitting Moran testimony seems very flawed in that sense.
So just to clarify, I think what Your Honor is describing is their argument on appeal, which the government's argument in terms of lack of preservation is not one they presented to the district court.
Okay.
To the district court, they said, we want this in because, you know, we need to, Shafa's intent is at issue and we want to put it in for Shafa's intent. And the district court did make a finding of no similar motive for that, because he did ask to admit it on that basis. And she said, well, I don't see a similar motive because there was no interest of the government to cross-examine Moran about his relationship with the Shafas. Did he tell any of this to the Shafas in the Guberman trial? So she made the finding for the thing he asked it for. She didn't make a finding as to similar motive on Moran's intent sort of standing alone, like whether he communicated anything to Shafa or not, because he didn't ask the court to do that. Then separately, I think this issue about aiding and abetting and whether the government proceeded on that theory, that's the government's argument about prejudice, lack of prejudice, prong three prejudice. And so what the government is saying is that there's no reasonable probability here that he was convicted by the jury of smuggling solely on the aiding and abetting theory. Because if it was both, there'd still be no prejudice because he's only appealing admission as to aiding and abetting. So if it's direct liability and aiding and abetting, no prejudice. So he needs to show under plain error that there's a reasonable probability that the jury convicted him only on an aiding and abetting theory for smuggling. And the government's position is there's no reasonable probability that's the case. He suggests in his reply brief the jury likely would have skipped direct liability, gone straight to aiding and abetting because Moran was the shipper. But that assumes the jury was ignoring the jury instructions, because the court correctly instructed Shafa could be guilty of aiding and abetting only if Shafa knew the customs descriptions were false. You still have to find Shafa's intent to convict, because that's the advanced knowledge requirement for aiding and abetting. But if they found Shafa knew they were false, then also under the jury instructions, he's directly liable because he's the importer of record. So it doesn't make sense then to think the jury's skipping over the direct liability theory the government argued in closing, that's much more straightforward, and just skip that entirely and just went to the more attenuated aiding and abetting theory and saying we're going to find Moran's intent and Shafa's intent and convict just on that basis without the direct liability. So that's the government's position on that.
Counsel, I think you did, though, argue in your brief that below, the government was not pursuing an aiding and abetting liability, and Judge Lopez, I was a little concerned about that because I wasn't sure the record was consistent with that argument. So one factual question I have for you is, did the government request the aiding and abetting instruction?
My understanding, my recollection is yes. It, when we filed proposed jury instructions, that was in there.
So how can we conclude that you weren't pursuing that theory when you requested an instruction on it?
I think what the government is relying on here is how this court has looked at prejudice in the past, which is a sort of practical whole record analysis of, like, do we actually think the jury's relying on this bit that you're saying is problematic? And so on that basis, the courts often looked at the government's closing argument and said, well, okay, which theories are you really pressing with the jury that we think the jury's then going to be thinking about? Because obviously if we pressed aiding and abetting very hard in closing, then that does look prejudicial. Here we didn't mention aiding and abetting once during the trial, not in opening, not in closing, not in any examination where we focused on, like, let's just look at Moran's intent, like, without looking at Shafa's, which would be the aiding abetting argument he's making. So that's the government's argument, that we weren't pursuing it, but I recognize that it's not as strong of a case given that it's in the indictment, we asked for the instruction, that is a different situation.
In the similar interest, the question of what's a similar interest, is that a factual determination by the district court?
Yes, I think it's a, I mean, it may be mixed so in that there's some, like.
So how do we review that? Do we have any case law on that? Because the reason I ask is that if I'm following your position, the only similar interest finding requested below was with respect to a different scenario than the similar interest finding that they're now advancing on appeal.
That's correct.
So we wouldn't have a finding one way or the other as to there was such a similar interest.
Yeah.
Is it? Now, I take it then if you're right about that, then we're on plain error.
That's correct.
And there's just no way they could win because it's dependent on a fact that they never asked to be found.
Right. So in the government's brief, we cite a case on that proposition. Yep. That, you know, they keep arguing the court didn't make this finding. The court didn't make the finding because they didn't ask the court to make the finding.
But you're treating it as a factual finding that has to be made by the district court that we review for clear error?
I think there are definitely factual aspects to it because you're looking at both, you know, a transcript, of course, the court has that in the prior trial, but also an understanding of what's going on in the instant trial and what the motives are there. So I think there's certainly a level of deference, if not fully factual, that you would give to the district court in understanding what the motives are in the two situations. There probably also is an overlay of what the legal standard is, of course.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please reintroduce himself on the record? He has a 2-minute rebuttal.
Thank you. Martin Weinberg for the appellant. In terms of the sentencing issues, the Kumar case, which Judge Rickleman sat on, is a very different case. He ran a call center in India that lied about the drugs that were being sent to America being FDA approved when they're not. He pled guilty. There was no acquitted conduct issue, and the charges in the Kumar case were a felony conspiracy that he pled guilty to and not a misbranding misdemeanor. Second is that we did raise the issue that fraud was not inherent in the smuggling convictions at page 87 of our original brief, where we talked about the two different ways under the instructions.
But that won't matter if we can still look at the factual means by which this fraud, this smuggling offense was carried out, insofar as the relevant offense is smuggling, not misbranding.
Yes, and there we have two arguments, which is that the limited deceit to customs was inherent in smuggling. The commission didn't put 2B1 in their index as an alternative. They could only, therefore, go through the misbranding, and in misbranding there was no sufficient evidence of patient fraud, and the patient fraud was an acquittal that didn't relate to
the— What's the second argument?
That's a combination of both of those two arguments. One, that the facts were missing, and two, that—
And that's why I'm having trouble. What facts are missing that would permit you to conclude that the smuggling was the right offense to be focused on? Here it was carried out in a way that was deceitful.
That there was multiple ways that the jury—
That seems like a categorical approach. Are you just saying there's no way on this record to say it's more likely than not that it in such that it was clear error to conclude that it was actually carried out with fraud.
The facts in this case that involve customs deceit were at the value, and the guideline talks about an enhancement to the smuggling guidelines for a loss of taxes, and the second false statement to customs was as to the plastic beads versus drugs. These are not the kind of false statements that support a fraud cross-reference. They're within the heartland of smuggling. They're within the heartland of the smuggling guideline. The commission had this enhancement for lost customs duties, and they were not factually sufficient to warrant a substitution of a fraud guideline. And plus, it was the acquittal for conspiracy that went back to 2008. The judge imposed loss and gain based on patient fraud back to 2008, another use of acquitted conduct. In terms of Moran, if I could just have one more moment. Dr. Schaffer received these drugs under his own name, his own credit card, his own email. The shipper was Mr. Moran. It is very plausible that the jury relied on Moran as the principal, the shipper, the exporter, and Schaffer is the aider and abettor that paid for it and received it. If the government doesn't want aiding and abetting as an alternative, don't ask for it. But they ask for it, it's instructed at length, it provided the jury with a second pathway to conviction. The juries follow instructions, or at least we premise our appellate decisions on their following instructions, and there is every bit as likelihood they found an aiding and abetting rather than a principal theory to find Dr. Schaffer culpable of smuggling.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in this case.